So thanks, Jacopo, for the introduction. I'm very happy to be here. I have to say I'm very happy to be here. And I want to thank Ellie and Rob for this, for making it happen. And yes, I guess you're going to be part of a small experiment for the Quantum Foundations group. Because, I'm very happy to be here because actually 10 years ago, it's 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to spend one full year here, like literally one full year in here, within these walls. And I don't know, it's like during PSI, you learn these things that you have to be bold, you have to be brave, and feel and follow your guts, right? And I'm very happy to present this, these ideas and these results in here, because I think that they follow this spirit. We'll explain some connections that we found between machine learning and these tensor networks that actually a lot of people in this building know about. And they are pretty special. So I don't know, like I hope that this is not too boring for you guys. I know it's gonna be a bit different, a bit of a different talk, but I hope you learn something. Okay, so I'm not gonna lie to you. This like is intended to be a talk about machine learning, and that's okay. And like, but I consider myself a physicist. I did my undergrad in physics. I did my bachelor's in here, theoretical physics. I did my PhD in physics. Then I worked in a couple of math departments, but I still consider myself a physicist. And I don't know if you guys like now that there's so many like works in machine learning and it's so popular. If you ever like wondered into like how does that work and how like what's the theory behind it? Well, at least my personal experience and from the times that I've given similar talks, it's not just my only one. It looks like something like this. At least at the very beginning, it's just this field like full of heuristics that just work. And typically it works for like because of scale, and the way of solving issues is kind of like, yeah, you just try something a bit different and see if it works again, or restart with a new seed, stuff like this. Which at the beginning was a bit frustrating, and actually, I've been trying to do throughout the years, in the means of my possibilities, is trying to figure out some meaning out of all this. But it's undeniable that even if it's with these heuristics or like this way of proceeding, machine learning works. And every year we are seeing more applications. And when I started giving these talks, ChatGPT didn't exist. And now we have this huge large language models and so on. So it seems like it's working and we should start caring about it. But this is not going to be a talk about the good things about machine learning. Like those are easy and they don't give things to think about. What I'm gonna talk about is about its problems, which would not be such of a problem, some of them, if it were not for the reason that we want to use machine learning in applications that involve humans. We want to use machine learning in medicine. We want to use machine learning in the processing of our data. And because of that, some problems that current machine learning models have may become a big issue, and it may even prevent its application, the application of machine learning in certain scenarios. And in Europe, we have this very clear example with our regulatory framework, which is having some clashes with ChatGPT, just to put an example. But also, actually, Canada is one of the spearheads in this deeper implications of machine learning. And you have also like concerns in terms of fairness, so how algorithms are applied to different class of, well, technically it's different classes of data, but in the end, these things are thought in the sense of different being applied to different, like individuals with different backgrounds or different traits. Okay? So this is the kind of problems that I've been trying to care about. Like, how can we make machine learning algorithms that protect our privacy or like do not reveal data about reveal information about the data that it's been trained on? How can we make fairer algorithms that consider all classes of data points in the same footing, and so on and so forth? And actually, this talk is going to be about how physics can help in the problem of privacy in machine learning. So just to have a small show of hands, who of you know about machine learning a little bit? Okay, good. And about privacy in machine learning? Good. Okay. So I'm going to summarize both of them in just one slide. That's the challenge now. So for those that do not know or haven't heard about machine learning, I'm going to abstract it away as much as possible, but in a way that I think it's useful for physics minded people. And it's that we typically have, okay, I'm going to focus on one particular paradigm of machine learning, which is the supervised learning, in which the setting is the following. You have some labeled data sets, so some data points and associated labels, and you want to find a function that maps your data points to the corresponding labels. So typically what you do is that you choose a family of functions, an ansatz for your model, and by some means you find the right parameters that give the good function from inputs to outputs. And that's it. Like machine learning, you can understand like machine learning as that. Then it's true that there's a lot of things, there's a lot of small details. And in particular, not only you want to describe the data points that you are using for this training, but you also want the model to behave well in unseen data. And that is precisely where all these heuristics come about. But for us physicists, machine learning is as simple as we have an ansatz and we want to choose the right function within that ansatz, which within that family. So typical example, if you've attended any machine learning talk at some point, you've heard about these cats and dogs. This is a typical example that everyone does. You have a data set where you have, for example, images of cats and images of dogs, and you want to somehow draw the boundary between the images that correspond to cats and images that correspond to dogs. And here I have an example. So say that I have found this this boundary over here. Actually, I want to have the hockey stick closer. I haven't used one of these in a while. But now let's consider what happens if the data set is slightly different. Say that I have one more image of a dog. Now I follow the same procedure and I try to find the best function that separates the two classes, and it may be that the function is different. I mean, no wonder, right? You have more data, or you have different data, you could expect that you have a different boundary. You have a different function as your optimal one. But this is precisely the point. If you have different decision boundaries for different data sets, can I invert this and by looking at the boundaries, by looking at the models, can we extract information from the training data set? The answer is that yes, you can. Otherwise, this wouldn't be a problem. I wouldn't be giving this talk. I wanted to enter a lot into like all the problems that you can have with this. I'm going to focus on one particular example of privacy attacks that will be relevant for illustrating all that's coming afterwards. And it's precisely this formulation of, given a boundary, can I tell, in this particular case, whether a particular data point was part of the training set or not. This is called membership inference. And there's been a lot of research throughout the years in this sort of problems, because essentially, one could tell whether a particular data point is being used in a training data set or not. That may mean, for example, is this patient in this hospital or not? Or did this patient or did this person use whichever service or not? This is pretty important data. Just to give a magnitude of the problem, I don't want to enter into the details a lot, but just as an illustration, here we have one example of one of the studies that was conducted on a data set, models trained on data sets by Google. And the lesson that I want to tell you here is that there's cases in which you can pretty well discern whether a particular data point was or not in the training data set. Like, accuracy is close to 90%. This is a pretty big deal. Because it's a pretty big deal, people have been trying to prevent this, to protect against this sort of problems or vulnerabilities. And actually, like, there's a lot of research, there's a lot of very good research in this, and actually the solutions are being also used in industry. So when Apple claims that they are privately handling your data, and Google claims that they are privately doing machine learning on your data, because now they will not say they are not doing processing on your data. They will claim that they are doing it, but in a private way, so no one else can know what's going on. They use mathematically rigorous tools for this. And this is so an example is this differential privacy, which this is an article that actually I came up to know a couple of days ago. Like, for example, how do Apple prepare the memories and the memories albums in a way that doesn't reveal who are you or where you were and things like this? Well, it's using this sort of algorithms. But again, very simple, what do? Is that they add noise to the data. They use it, they add noise in a crafted way and so on and so forth. The point is that they add noise to the data, and this has some consequences. The most important one is that you're adding noise. That means that in order to train your algorithms, you're gonna struggle a bit more, you need more compute power, or you need larger data sets, and so on and so forth. My personal experience working with these things, is that either you're Google or Apple and you have billions of data points, or your algorithms don't work at all. But also, there's more subtle things. Also thinking in terms of these issues, these current issues of machine learning, like privacy, fairness, and so on, because it's been shown that using these measures of protecting privacy have effects also, for example, in the fairness of the algorithms. So it's been shown that you use these differentially private mechanisms, and then these affect more to the minority classes in your data. So they extract the information from the majority classes, and the minority classes are kind of like washed out. And this is something that you don't want. All right. So, and then, so we started thinking about these things, how could we help, and so on and so forth. And actually, the first thing that we found was not a solution, but a new privacy vulnerability that, to our knowledge, was not recognized yet. And it's the following. Just to set up a bit the notation, let me go back and set up the scenario. So in an abstract way, we're gonna have a process by which we have different data sets. So say we have a promise that it's either this data set or T1 or the data set T2 that are used to train some neural network, okay? And then this neural network, this model and parameters are given to an attacker that tries to figure out whether the model was trained with T1 or T2. In this scenario, it's easy to phrase this membership inference problem that we were talking a bit before. So in membership inference, you have a situation like this. So you have that your dataset T1 is the colored dots, the colored points, and your dataset T2 is the colored points plus the black one. And you want to teleport whether it's one or the other. The vulnerability that we are going to care about, and the one that we discovered, has to do instead with this other situation. So here the premise is that either you trained your model with a data set like this one in the top, or you trained it with a data set like this one in the bottom. Okay? So if you think a bit closely, you'll see that the answer to both, so the boundaries that separate these two data sets, or these two classes, and the boundary that separates these two classes, should be pretty much the same. Because if you think a bit closely, in these data sets, you have a variable that is irrelevant for the classification. Actually, the optimal is just doing a vertical line. The best classifier would be a vertical line. But then, and this, for example, can be morbidity in medical records. So imagine that you're a hospital, that you're conducting some sort of study, and you have all these medical records of patients. And for some reason, there's a disease that ends up not being related to what you're trying to predict. Say, I don't know, gout on risk of having a heart attack, for example. I'm making this up. I'm not claiming that this is an actual connection, but imagine something like this. And there's this hospital that's trying to predict this with the data of their patients, and it seems like there's a large majority of the patients that does have gout. And then another hospital is trying to do the same study, and the patients in there do not have, the large majority do not have gout. So this is a variable that is completely, it turns out to be completely irrelevant for the learning task, but you have it in different proportions. Is it possible to tell apart these two, like in which data was each of the models trained? And our claim is yes, and I'll show a few examples now. Also important, it's not clear at all that differential privacy helps here. So differential privacy was working in, was using, adding this noise. And it makes sense that it kind of works in this situation where you want to protect against one point, because if you blur the points enough, then it becomes indistinguishable from the rest. But here, in the situation where when you want to tell about this data set, like a model trained on this data set and a model trained on this data set, the thing that you want to protect about is a property that belongs to many, many of the points in your data set. So it's not clear at all that differential privacy helps here. Okay, so I claim that I can tell these two apart. Two models train each on one of the different data sets, I can tell them apart. And actually, I'm gonna start, in order to build intuition, with a very simple example. Not related to any like real data. Let's have a toy model in which you have a two-dimensional data set. So we're gonna have two points of two dimensions, xrel and xir. The names will become evident in a while. And for those that those of you that have not had experience with neural network, this can be your first neural network. So technically, it's a one-layer neural network with a tangent, like hyperbolic tangent activation. Essentially, you're just doing some affine transformation on your data, and you're normalizing to be between -1 and 1. Okay. So let's take one of these data sets of random points with xrel and xir, and the task that you want to train your algorithm on, or you want to train your boundary on, is on learning this function, the sine of xrel. So now I guess it makes sense. The notation makes sense. So xrel, because there's one relevant variable, and the learning task should only depend on this one. And then there is another irrelevant variable whose value should be completely useless for making the prediction. Okay? So what would be the ideal thing? That this wrel is as large as possible, and these two, wir and b, these parameters, are essentially zero. This would be the ideal scenario. So we start, let's start a couple of training procedures. So in this graph, I'm showing, so each point is a model, okay? So it's the parameters, this W, R, and the bias, B, for one model that will be trained, okay? And the orange circles, I'm gonna train them with data sets for which the irrelevant variable has the value of minus one. For the blue stars, I'm going to train the model with points, sorry, with data sets for which the relevant variable is plus one. Ideally, no matter which data set I choose, because the relevant variable is irrelevant, I should get a boundary that's independent of X error. It's independent of the value of the irrelevant variable in the training data set, and it would not be possible to tell apart a given model which data set it was using. Okay? Well, you go doing this this process, and you see that after training, there is correlations between the values of the relevant weight and the bias. And these correlations are different depending on the training data set. And it kind of makes sense. If you think about it a little bit, it kind of makes sense. So you're training this guy, okay? And you figure out that this dimension is the important one. The X-rel is the important one. The way in which you, of course, the optimal way to eliminate the rest of the information is setting this guy and this guy to zero. But this doesn't happen in practice because you have finite data and you have finite training steps. So what ends up happening is that this contribution tries to cancel out. If you have that the relevant variable is positive, the way in which this cancels out, or most effectively cancels out in average, is by having W, R, and B having opposite parities. And then they align along this line over here. And if W, R is negative, the way in which this thing cancels out in average is by having W, R, and B having the same parity. But then this means that I give you a model, which is I give you the parameters, and I ask you, can you figure out what was the value of W error that, again, it was a variable that it's completely irrelevant for the classification task, for the learning task. But can you tell me what was the value of W error in, sorry, not that W error, of X error in the training data set? And it's super easy. You just compute the parity of these two parameters, W, R, and B, and that's your solution. And you can say, okay, well, this is a super simple toy example. It's two dimensions. It's very tailored to like the particular problem that you're dealing with. Okay, it's not that a particular toy example. First, because this will happen for any loss function. If you compute, I don't know, the mean square error between this guy, and you compute gradients of that, you'll see that the gradients with respect to W error and the gradients with respect to B depend on X error. Okay, so in the training process, no matter the loss function, the training process is going to move these two parameters into different regimes depending on the value of this irrelevant feature in the training dataset. But if I haven't convinced you yet, I have an example on real data. Well, real data, quote unquote. So we wanted to do an example a bit more complicated using medical records. So the task here is that we have these medical records of COVID cases, and we had a lot of like demographics and symptoms and information like this. And from it, we wanted to predict the outcome of the disease, okay? So, and here's why it's quote-unquote real data. To this, we added a variable that we know it was completely, it should be completely irrelevant for this task of predicting the outcome, which is the parity of the date in which the case was recorded. The date may matter in the sense that it's not the same if you got COVID in March 2020 or March 2022, but the parity of the date should be completely irrelevant. And actually, we see that when we train models in trying to predict the outcome of the disease, this variable is completely irrelevant. This is these two lines in the top. So here we are training different models on data points or on data sets for which the only difference is the amount of percentage of points that have even parity or odd parity for this variable, for this date of case registration. And you see that the results are pretty much the same, first across the percentage of points of one of the for each of the types, and also between types. So it doesn't matter if it's trained on a majority of data points with even parity or a majority of data points with odd parity. Okay. So at a black box level, if you just do queries to these models, you will not see a difference. But what happens when you look open the black box and you look at the parameters? Then you can tell them apart. So here I'm plotting this accuracy on predicting, which was the original data set, whether it was trained on a data set with a majority of points with even parity or with odd parity. And we do like the simplest, so in order to do this curve, what we do is that, moreover, we give a lot of power to the adversary. So we not only give them this particular model that you want to tell apart, but we give them a whole collection of labeled models, in the sense that I give the attacker a collection of this model was trained on a data set with them where the majority of points had even parity. This model was trained on a data set whose majority of points had odd parity, so on and so forth. So with that, the attacker can build like a meta model in which the input is a model and the output is a label. We choose for this the simplest model that that one can think of, which is a one-layer neural network or a logistic regressor. And with this information, it's very easy to tell apart. Well, it's very easy to predict what was the nature of this irrelevant variable in the training dataset of a particular model. Okay. Are there any questions so far? So this is kind of like the first part of this new vulnerability that people didn't figure out before. So now it comes the solution, right? For those of you that I have already lost, now it's the time to like get you again, because before entering into the details, I want to give a glimpse of what we achieved. So essentially, here's the curve that you get for the ability of attackers to predict this value of the irrelevant variable when you train neural networks. Now the rest of the talk is going to be about why, if you use different architectures, and here's where the physics is going to come out, you get curves like this, eventually reaching to the absolute minimum. So how you can really protect against this sort of vulnerabilities if you're a bit clever on the architectures that you use. Okay, so let's see how we get this graph. And the question that triggered us to trying to figure out this is, well, what should we expect from a good model, right? What is a good machine learning model? And here, like, this is an opinion, so you may disagree with it. A model is well-trained, and it's a good model, if from the dataset, it only extracts the information that it's important to perform the task well, and nothing else. It's not memorizing, it's not overfitting. It's just you extracting and using the information that allows it to generalize. Okay? This has a consequence, and it's that if this model is well-trained, access, so looking at it from a black box perspective, just doing queries to it, and just looking at the model and its parameters, should give the same information about the training data set. Or perhaps said in another way, the access to the parameters should not be more informative about the training data set than black box access. All right? How do we achieve this? In the ideal world, we'd say, okay, so we have this model, which via black box access, you cannot tell which was the data set. You cannot tell information about the data set it was trained on. But on a white box access, so looking at the parameters, you can tell it apart. You can tell it. Well, ideally, you'd find a way that does not depend on the data set, in which you find new parameters that describe your exact same model and do not reveal this information, because you've chosen them in a way that does not depend on the data set. This would be awesome. This would be ideal. But it's kind of like unrealistic, right? Or is it? Because this notion of alternative parameterizations of a same function is something that actually a lot of people in this building know about. In the language of physics, this is gauge symmetries. So why not trying to push this a bit further? Actually, this is the first nice result that we got, where we were able to formally connect the concept of gauge symmetry with, in this case, it's going to be an equivalence between black box and white box access to a model. So in order to explain the result more or less properly, let me introduce some notation here. So we're going to have this manifold in the bottom. It's going to be the manifold of models given by white box access. So fixed a particular architecture, a particular family of models. This is the manifold of all possible parameter values for that model. And each point, for that family. And each point corresponds to a particular choice of parameters, which gives you a particular model. Okay? And in the top, I'm going to have the space, which will turn out in some cases to be a manifold as well, of models given by black box access. And this, for example, in order to see it in a simple way, if you think of binary functions that take binary inputs and binary outcomes, this can be the space of all truth tables. Okay. For example, one can imagine that it's easy for, given a model, compute its black box. I mean, this is what Google now does, that you give them the data set, and they train a model, and then you input more, you send some data points to the cloud, and the cloud returns the outcomes. So there are also like black box models right now in the context of machine learning. But typically, you have a function, we're going to call it pi, that takes you from the space of white boxes to the space of black boxes. And what we want to find is something like this, a way of moving within the space of white boxes that gives us a different parameterization of the same model. So when you apply pi to this other model, you end up with the same black box. Okay? So with this, I want to explain a bit in detail what we actually proved. Okay? So what we proved is that if one can characterize the sets of parameters that did leave a model invariant, so the orbits in this place of white boxes for your models, and this is something that is important, there is a way of inverting this function pi and assigning to each black box a corresponding white box, then you have privacy. Because any function that you can apply to this guy is equivalent to a function that is applied to the black box via this map. Okay? A bit more intuitively, if you have two points in here that go to the same black box, then no matter in which point you start, you go to the same black box, you apply alpha, and you get to the same parameters. So if you have two models that behave at the exact same black box but have different parameters, here there is a way to bring them to the same black, to the same white box. And then this information that was in the white box, it was in the parameters of each of the models. Now it's not there anymore because you've arrived to this box, to this model via two different starting points. So okay, a bit more in the machine learning jargon. The lesson of this theorem is that if some information cannot be accessed from queries, then neither it can be accessed from the parameters of this representative of your orbit. Which is cool. For example, in the problem that we had, in which we had this irrelevant feature, this irrelevant variable that did not have any impact in the, well, in the ideal case had no impact on the choice of the boundary, and we saw that the models as a black box were behaving pretty much the same, then this theorem means that if you use an architecture that has gauge symmetries, then you will not be able to tell that information from the parameters of these models. Okay? Now, which architectures can we know that have these gauge symmetries? Actually, this is something that it's kind of fun because in the machine learning, like in the machine learning community, all this non-uniqueness of your models is a problem. You don't want to do an optimization process in which you can move in a direction that doesn't improve your or that does not have an impact on the training of your model. So people have fought really hard to find architectures that do not have this sort of things. And actually, a source, but in other fields, it's super common. It's something that people look for. And this is the case of tensor networks. I don't know if you guys have heard about tensor networks before. They came from the quantum manifold physics community because they provide efficient representations of quantum many-body systems, okay? So for those of you that don't know the notation, it's just network, like tensor networks are networks of tensors. So essentially, and these tensors are multidimensional families of numbers, which have as many legs as indices. And then you represent dot products with just a connection between indices. So for example, the product between a matrix and a vector is something like this. So you have this matrix M that has two legs, so we know it's a matrix, and this vector V that has one leg, so we know it's a vector, and the result has one free leg, so we know it's a vector. Okay? These are tools that are used a lot in quantum many-body physics, and recently they started also being used in machine learning. So essentially, you can think of these things as collections not of fixed parameters, or not of fixed numbers, but of trainable parameters. And then you start doing machine learning on this. It's very fun because the people that started doing this back in 2016 are the ones that taught me tensor networks back here in PSI. So it was that was a nice connection. But okay, just to give an example, a simple example. let's use one of these matrix product states. That if like if you know tensor networks, it's, you probably have heard about this. How would you use one of these for machine learning? Okay, so you just have your input data, which is in general some vector, like some collection of vectors. For each of the features, you embed it into a vector. So the input, you embed it in some kind of like trivial tensor network, although there's some freedom in which, in where to find, how to choose these functions, these embedding functions, although for a particular problem, you fix them. And then your family of functions is the contraction of your input with the corresponding tensor network. In this case, if you are doing multi-class classification, for example, you want that the output is a vector. And then you can understand this as your family of functions. You define your loss function, you do gradient descent, and you optimize it. It's true that, okay, this is very cool. But so far, one cannot compete with, like, especially these huge architectures that we have now, just for a reason of scale. But I hope that this work actually is pushing a bit the idea that accuracy is not all that you want, and if you care about particular problems, you better try out new alternatives like these ones. But okay, it's still in specific scenarios and in concrete scenarios, it seems like it makes sense to use this. These architectures instead of traditional neural networks. And one example can be, how is it called? Anomaly detection. There, in that particular case, it seems like tensor networks are working a bit better than neural networks. But okay. So we are, yes?
Very basic question. How do you make a nonlinear function out of these tensors?
So here, the nonlinearities essentially come in the embedding. So it's a very good question because, you see here, it's very clear that your family of functions is a hyperplane on the space of the embedded data. So what you can do is that this embedding is nonlinear. So for example, this embedding you would use, for example, you could use vectors. Where do I have a chalk? So you could, you could make that your phi of x is a vector 1x x square, for example. And then it's true that you're doing a hyperplane, but you're doing it on the space of the tensor products of these guys. So you can, if you can have approximation of polynomial functions. And if you can have approximation of polynomial functions, you're pretty good. But that's a very good question indeed. All right. So how does this architecture, like why are these architectures interesting for this privacy preservation and so on? Because especially in the case of these matrix product states, the gauge symmetry is very well characterized. We know exactly what it is, and it's easy to work with it. Essentially, what you would do is that okay, you have your parameters in the purple and orange nodes, and say that you've achieved this by some sort of training. What you can do is in the green diamonds, you insert resolutions of the identity. So you put an identity matrix here, and here, and here, and here, and here. And these, you decompose them as some random x and x minus 1. And now what you do is that for each of the nodes, you absorb the x from one of the sides and the x minus 1 from the other side. Now all of a sudden, you have a completely new family of parameters for your model that nevertheless, once you contract everything, the x and x minus 1 parts cancel out, and you end up having the exact same function. And let me stress this. you're getting the exact same function, as opposed to differential privacy, where you had to add noise and then affect the model that you're getting. And also, something that's important in practice is that this way, this path from the space of black boxes to the space of white boxes is very easy to do. You just do single order value decompositions. Actually, you can just do it from here. You can go directly from here without having to go to the black box space. It's very well characterized, although I'll show a detail in a minute about this. So we have it. Awesome. We have a family of models that seems to be privacy preserving. Actually, there is one more detail that I want to talk about, and is what if the black boxes are not the same? In practice, you would expect that you have finite data, you have finite rounds of training, so you may expect that the black boxes that you arrive to by training onto data sets that have some irrelevant feature are not exactly the same. And maybe, like, intuitively, one would think, okay, if I have two black boxes that are not the same, okay, I can tell them apart in the space of black boxes just by doing queries. At some point, I will figure out that they are given different predictions. But intuitively, one would think that it may be easier to figure out if they are different or not in the space of white boxes, because you have more information about your model. You have all the parameters of your model. Well, we managed to prove that if you use MPS as your machine learning architectures, this is not the case. There is a notion between, so there is a correspondence between being close in the space of black boxes and being close in the space of white boxes. And the way in which we prove it, okay, here's the statement, but essentially it's just saying that if we have two black boxes that are close by, and these black boxes correspond to matrix product states, then the corresponding canonical forms, the parameters that represent, that the parameters that correspond to representatives of these two black boxes are also close by. And the way in which we prove this is by giving one of these alpha, one expression of a canonical form, that is smooth. So we give this alpha that goes from the space of black boxes to the space of white boxes, and it's a smooth function. And this smoothness kind of guarantees that points that are close by are maps to points close by. But it's true that it's a bit of a more qualitative result. You can do things like computing Lipschitz coefficients and so on, but we did not do that yet. And actually, this was very nice, or we were very happy about it, because it's also the first univocal canonical form for matrix product states. So this may be of interest also for the people in condensed matter. Why this can be interesting? So I said that before, that if you want to compute canonical forms of matrix product states in condensed matter, well, you do this singular value decomposition. And this should fix, this should map all my matrix product states that are gauge equivalent to the same one. It is not quite the case, because the singular value decomposition leaves a remaining U1 symmetry that is not fixed. Typically, this is not a problem, but we will see that in a bit that in the context of privacy, it does become a bit of a problem. And actually, this canonical form fixes it, because this is essentially what we are doing here is just some projections, so some choices of rows and columns of the matrix that represents our MPS, and fixing, like, correcting by some inverses at some point. So as long as the inverse, like the computation of the inverse, is not singular, it's all a matter of multiplications and sums, and all this is smooth. So this procedure gives a univocal representative to each class of matrix product states. We were very happy. But then, I don't know if you've heard this saying that everything that you discover, it's known to the Russians in the 80s. This was the case. So after we put the paper on archive and we were publicizing in conferences and so on, there was this guy that comes one day to a poster of a student and says like, okay, I know this. This sounds familiar. And actually, this sort of factorization was known since the 2010s. So it's not the 80s, but kind of close. where these tensor networks and matrix product states are used for numerical integration. And then they develop this sort of factorization in a completely independent way. Okay, still nice. It's good to have the validation of some Russian theorists. Okay, so here's where we are now. I'm close to finishing, I promise. So what did we get from this? It's essentially these two results. First, in architectures that have gauge symmetries, access to a canonical form, access to this representatives of the gauge orbits, gives an equivalence between access to black boxes, black box access and white box access to a model. So notice that here there's no word about tensor networks, there's no word about the MPS. This, I think it's a good motivation to convince the machine learning people, and this is something I'm trying, but it's hard, for them to look for architectures that have gauge symmetries. Because then you have privacy for some concerns, not for all of them, but for some issues, you have privacy for free. Without, again, no adding noise, no complicated computations, just for free. And then the second result is particular to MPS. And it's essentially that if you have two models that behave similarly as black boxes, then there is a representation in which they are close as white boxes. So there's not only if there is no information in the black box, you won't be able to find it in the white box, but if there is some information in the black box, it will be as hard to extract in the white box as in the black box. And now we have all the tools to understand this graph that I showed at the beginning. Just as a brief reminder, we are in a situation where we are giving a model to an adversary, and this adversary has to tell apart whether the model was trained in a data set of type T1 or a data set of type T2. And this was the result for neural networks as the imbalance between this irrelevant variable was growing. Now, what do we have if we do the same problem? So if what we give to the adversary are not neural networks trained on the problem, but matrix product states. The first interesting or funny thing that we figured out is that if we train the matrix product state and we just give it to the adversary, this still has the information. I mean, it makes sense. We have done nothing funny. So this is the orange curve over here. So okay, there's some weird things going on when you have a high bias, but in general, just training the model is not enough, which makes sense. I mean, you're moving through this landscape that is defined by your data set, and you end up in a point that depends on your data set. But then, say that you compute the canonical form using singular value decomposition. This is a green line, and it works pretty well for kind of like low bias, but then you see it starts to grow. This is precisely the effect of this lingering U1 symmetry that was not fixed by the singular value decomposition. We see this explicitly. And actually, the higher the bias, the stronger the effect. The more information is encoded in that gauge. So then what do? Either you randomize over this gauge, and then you get the red line, or you use our new canonical form, and then you get the purple line. And you see that there's no way you can tell apart the two models if you are doing these procedures. And okay, that's essentially all I wanted to say. Yep.
The pair of models, which the adversary is trying to decide, did you train on this or did you train on that? Like the two mm-hmm. training sets. They are constructed so that they would lead to the same MPS plus U. Like that is the...
Yes. I mean, we do not tailor the data sets so that they give that. So the different in the difference in the data sets.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you can think of them as they are IID on the relevant data. So they are, they both, like for the relevant part,
mm-hmm.
demographics and symptoms and so on, they are sampled from a big chunk of from a bigger data set that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And for the irrelevant part, disparity of the date, this we sample from kind of like disjoint distributions. In this case, in the case of complete bias, they are sampled from disjoint distributions. So there you have, in one case, a majority of data points that whose the parity of the date of registry of a record is odd, and the other data set has the same proportion of points but that are even. But for the relevant part, the data sets are the same.
Encoding where like you are insisting sort of the irrelevant variable
yes.
encoded into the relevant part of the MPS.
So the irrelevant part, the irrelevant information is part of the input to the MPS. Yes, and the MPS processes it as if the MPS does not know that this is irrelevant. Then it may be that...
But you do.
Like, I do, yes.
And that's critical in the encode. So basically what I'm saying is, it seems to me like...
I mean...
From your first theorem, you said like if these two sort of black boxes mapped into the same mm-hmm. box, then you have like this kind of notion of privacy.
Yeah.
So suppose that you had not resolved this complete univocal canonical form,
mm-hmm.
But just sort of this sort of Schmidt decomposition.
Yeah.
If you encoded the irrelevant parameters
mm-hmm.
into equivalence under the singular value decomposition, and you said like, okay, we're gonna take that variability
yeah.
and make it within this kind of variability, which is only in terms of the singular values, but
yes.
so right, then it seems like you could have done the exact same thing, but you would have had like MPS plus C would have been flat. So
yes, so actually
just
like,
been like and yeah. I'm trying to yeah. understand like the
yes.
advantage is that like you can, you know, gain sort of compression because you can sort of hold more irrelevant information in the same size tensor network, whereas if you wanted to like use a gauge symmetry which is smaller and like there's, you know, more freedom, then you'd have had to use like a larger tensor network in order to like represent the same invariance, or am I
so we went through all this process and always like saying that there is this irrelevant variable and this is all the points, so on and so forth, because and we do keep track of where the say the relevant variable is, because we want to show that this works.
Mm-hmm.
But the prescription that we're giving is, or can be as simple as, use a machine, like use a family of models that has some gauge symmetry, train it, and you can then just sample over the gauge.
Yes.
These new parameters, so the information that you can extract from these parameters is equivalent to the information that you can extract from black box access.
I agree. But how do you say, like, I'm going to begin by saying, like, in my training data,
mm-hmm.
I have a notion of what constitutes an irrelevant parameter.
Ah, exactly, yes.
Because yeah. I could say I want to infer the irrelevant parameters
mm-hmm.
by saying, like, they are the things that correspond to the gauge symmetry. But you're saying, I have like a prior notion of what's irrelevant.
No, that, so.
And I'm making sure that this prior notion of irrelevance is mapped to the gauge symmetry.
Okay, so that's a very important point. Because Had I not known that there was an irrelevant variable, so people, like, there is a lot of work into discerning, given a data set and a task, which variables are triggering a particular prediction, which information do you need to trigger a prediction, and so forth. There's a lot of analysis in the relevance of the input into the output. People use it for example, to reduce the size of the datasets. If I do not need this information to do my prediction, well, then let's just not use it. But this implies you have your data, you train a model, you figure out what's irrelevant, you take it out, you train another model. Here, you don't need to do anything of this. If there is, so we do not say, we do not explicitly map the irrelevant variables or the irrelevant information to the gauge. It just, in a sense, it just so happens. In a sense, yes, because what we, I mean, in brief, we just say, if you have a gauge symmetry and you have a representative, then you have the information that you had via black box access. You have a black box. Mm-hmm. Whatever you can figure out in the black box, you will also be able to figure out from the parameter, these parameters that I'm giving you. But if there is something that you cannot access, you cannot know via black box queries, then you will not be able to learn it or to extract it. So it's not quite, we're pushing this to the gauge.
I see.
It so happens that we have some parameters that exactly describe black box access, like the model as a black box.
Right, and so the idea is that there are these differences beyond the singular values,
yes,
which are not detectable by sort of queries to the black box.
Yes, yeah, okay, yes. I now I'm listening.
Your irrelevant parameters as the things which are indistinguishable.
Yes, in that sense,
you
yes.
You find that these two training sets, which are indistinguishable under black box calls,
exactly,
are nevertheless distinguishable because there are these...
Exactly. In the end, like in practice, what you see is that you get to these two MPS that are equivalent, that give the same function, but you know, there's some coordination in the signs of the parameters, because this is a U1, it's essentially some faces. There's some coordination between some signs that is different in both cases. And you can only reach once on one type of data sets, and you can only reach the other ones in the other type of data sets, because, you know, it's the same thing that we had at the beginning, that the gradients are pushing towards one direction or the other direction.
Right.
But they are the same MPS, only that the implementations of singular value decomposition cannot mix these two together. If you had this coordination of minus signs, it goes there. You had this coordination of minus signs, or plus signs.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
There is a question online.
Uh-huh.
They ask, can we understand this irrelevant data as some sort of cost for the privacy of the experimenter?
Wow.
Is the size of the relevant information relevant for the process?
Those are two very good questions. About quantifying the irrelevance, I don't know. One of the conclusions that I have is that, these are first indications that something interesting and nice is happening, but there's a lot to be done. This is one of these things that could be very, very interesting because, you know, there is a notion of how private a model is in terms of differential privacy. So there's a kind of a way of quantifying how private a model is. But beyond that, there's, to my knowledge, nothing in the field. So this could be a very, very interesting thing to do. And then the other question was, the
size of the relevant information relevant for the process.
I would say, for this all this gauge symmetry stuff, I would say that no, of course, you need data from which you can learn what you want to do. But if you have more or less irrelevant information, this should not be a problem, because here we just have a phrasing in terms of white boxes and black boxes. And if there's something that's not in the black box, then it's done. Actually, we are now playing with more complicated things, like, I don't know, faces, like models for detecting smiles, for example, if a person is smiling or not, if the hair color makes a difference. It shouldn't. Well, then let's train with a data set with a lot of blonde people and data sets with a lot of black-haired people, and let's try to figure out if it's one or the other. This is not a particular dimension in your data set. It's a combination of a lot of pixels, but we're working on that. Yep.
Is the size of the irrelevant information affecting the speed of convergence of training?
This we don't know. Okay. This we don't know.
Speak online, say thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, because I think it's time to finish already. I just had a couple of notes here, but I've already gone through all of them during the talk. The first thing that we found nice is that by thinking of privacy from a physics perspective, the first thing that we found is a privacy vulnerability of neural networks. That was pretty cool, and I think it teaches a lesson of like being open to like interesting connections. We have these results that gauge symmetry implies a notion of privacy. And I think this is a very interesting avenue to try to convince the machine learning people to go deeper into this. Actually, this is something I'm working on. And then, attention networks provide a favorable playground to think about these things and play around a bit. Just the last slide. If you're interested in playing with tensor networks in machine learning, I have this student in Madrid, Jose Pareja, who implemented like a full, say, package or add-on, or you call it, to define, train, and playing with tensor networks on top of PyTorch. If you know about machine learning, PyTorch is one of these big libraries that a lot of people use. Now, with this package that Jose developed, you can not only define neural networks and convolutional, blah, 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 you can also define your tensor network, and it's super easy to do a concatenation of an MPS with a linear layer, and then a ReLU, and then a convolutional, and then another MPS, and then you just press train, and everything works out. It's very cool. So that's it. Thanks very much for your time, and if you have any more questions, I'm happy to take them.
So this is again the clarification question. Yeah. It seems to me like your tensor network has a shape.
Yes.
Certain number of sets. If the amount sort of the gauge symmetry is related to the size of the network, right? Like if the network has many sites, then you'll have a huge.
Yes.
If you have very few sites, then you won't have some symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
If your I can imagine a situation where, like, if your tensor network is exactly the right size, then it fits the things such that the relevant data is encoded and there's sort of the relevant part, and the irrelevant data, which is like not relevant to the targets, goes into sort of the gauge thing, and everything's good. But if your tensor network is too large, could it not be the case that the irrelevant data might end up outside the gauge symmetry? And if your tensor network is too small, then doesn't, like, obviously, like, you're not going to be able to get like great performance, like like you won't optimize your score. It's the same as if you had a larger network, because it's just not plugged enough. But Do you still know that like the irrelevant stuff then is put in into the symmetry?
So how would you how would you see that the relevant data is encoded somewhere? You'd go make queries and see that it's given different predictions for different values of the relevant data, right? This is a way of how you'd figure out. But then you have a difference in black box behavior. If there is a difference in black box behavior, I mean, because you can see it from queries, then theorem one does not hold. It does hold in the sense that the parameters are going to be equivalent to a black box. But if this black box is different for different data sets, well, if you can tell it apart from a black box perspective, you are going to be able to figure out.
To get over this preconception that there is a notion of irrelevance, which is sort of a priori, rather the notion of irrelevance is defined after you've learned as the things which are indistinguishable
from
their proof.
Yeah.
And okay, so you could take a similar thing, which is like, if you didn't use tensor networks, if you used a general neural net, you could still define what constitutes irrelevant data in the same way as the things which are thinking of queries, but there's just no sort of notion of like how you would then canonicalize your neural net.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly the point, indeed, and that's why like one interesting way of proceeding is try to find what are the gauge symmetries of popular machine learning architectures. Neural networks is very difficult, but perhaps transformers or things like this have some sort of symmetry. And if people manage to do that, then they will get this sort of like equivalence between black box and white box for free.
Okay, but you still don't have like the ability to sort of say like, I want to train it in such a way that the following feature is prime.
No, not at all. Yeah. Yep.
I heard that typically nowadays some people care about the opposite problem. Like, how do I figure out what's the source of this art? Let's say, I want to know who is the dominant artist that influenced this kind of style and so on. So this could be used also in the other way, like could measure, you could maybe take a large language model that they're using and check how much you can learn from it, thinking about it in the opposite direction.
Yeah, maybe.
It's like application dependent. Do you want privacy or do you want transparency?
Yes, for example, actually, one of I'm not sure if I put it at the beginning when I was showing these headlines and so on. I don't know if I put it, but if not, I like it went through like the candidates during last week that there may be a trade-off between transparency and privacy. And depending on what's your final goal, you may want to choose one method of training or another method of training. In that sense, these results kind of connect because it's true that so far, tensor networks cannot compete with standard neural networks in all problems. But if you care about privacy, maybe you want to consider using one of these instead of a neural network. Cool. Well, thank you very much.